My name is Dario Hasenstab. I have 2 degrees in international affairs, and I'm here with Balder Hagretz, a former university professor of mine, as well as an IR consultant. And together, we're bursting the Western bubble. Today, we will analyze the Eastern West through the lens of the Western bubble, because while Western societies have many strengths and significant weaknesses, in order to analyze these, we use the concept of the Western bubble. If you would like to know more about this concept, how this podcast started, or who we are, make sure to listen to our introduction episodes. Hi, Balder. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we speaking about the Eastern West?
Hi, Dario. We, in our podcast, but also in our daily lives, when we talk about the West, we are called the Western bubble, we obviously directly refer to the United States, Western Europe, sort of the core components of what is the foundation of Western philosophy, Western politics, etc. But we also, just like the media does, often inadvertently or directly include countries that aren't actually geographically the West, but fit into similar patterns. And then I'm particularly talking about Australia, New Zealand on the one hand, and South Korea, Japan on the other. They are part of the geopolitical environment in which the West operates. They are supported by and support the United States and Europe in many geopolitical issues. And therefore, we typically half-heartedly include them, but we also have to recognize that there's a difference between them and, if you like, the traditional West, the Western West. So we thought that today it would have been a good idea to actually explore that a little bit and to discuss what is the reality of those Eastern countries when it comes to the Western bubble. And specifically today, we are lucky to have a guest who is going to talk about the Australian experience, Daniel Block, who is a very good friend of ours. And he's going to join us later to specifically talk about Australia. So even though in the future, hopefully we get to delve into South Korea and Japan, hopefully as well with guests, today we're going to specifically explore Australia and to see to what extent Australia is part of that Western bubble.
And what are the facts?
While the West usually refers to NATO members located in Western Europe and North America, countries not limited to those geographic regions also fall into the Western bubble. Most obviously, Australia and New Zealand fall into this category, but Japan and South Korea can often be brought into the Western bubble as well. All of these countries usually vote with the United States in the United Nations at a rate of 50%. Furthermore, Japan and South Korea were both occupied by the United States in the 20th century and were shaped by the United States in their reconstruction.
What is the bubble?
This is an episode that I'm really looking forward to here, because I have been asked so many times by people in the past, what even is the West, right? And then I kind of tell them, well, it's NATO, but then also consider Japan, South Korea, New Zealand, Australia. And I mean, in some questions, we can also consider Latin America, but not really. It's a very difficult concept, right? I mean, are the Balkans part of it? How much is Eastern Europe part of it? Are we really only talking about Scandinavia, or is Iceland also part of the West? I mean, I'm really glad that we are kind of taking the time today to define this a little bit further.
Exactly. That is the word, right? Define. Because it really, the answer to those questions depends on your definitions. And this is exactly why typically we leave it a little bit vague and a little bit undefined, because we don't want to pin it down. I think at some point we might also do an episode on Latin America and to the extent to which Latin America connects to the West. So we know at a minimum who forms the core of the West. Not necessarily, you know, the most important ones. I don't mean core as in the ones that we care about most, but the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany. Those are clearly fundamental players within Western geopolitics and very much within the Western bubble, as we discuss in this podcast. And then it just depends. Do you define it geographically? Then obviously Japan and South Korea are not part of it. They're not in the geographical West. Do you define it geopolitically? Yes, Japan and South Korea play very similar games to that of Western European countries, for example. Is it cultural? No, culturally, you cannot really make this comparison that clearly. Culturally, we're talking about a very different approach to reality. So I think from our perspective, we need to kind of identify what we mean by the Western bubble and see to what extent those aspects of the Western bubble also apply to countries in the East, also apply to Australia, Japan, South Korea, New Zealand. And I think we will find that it will apply differently to some of those countries.
Because what we do see in those four countries that we've now specifically mentioned is, right, that there are similarities with regards to the political system, right, to ideas such as democracy, freedom, human rights, self-determination, and a general similarity to behavior on the international stage, right? And I mean, so this can be on the one hand seen through, I mean, just acting in accordance with the West, right? This is what I mentioned, the fact sheet with like voting in accordance with the West in the United Nations, but also participating in, in trade agreements, in defense pacts and agreements, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and a lot of that is not always easy to distinguish from simple strategic interests, right? So you might apply some of these issues that you just mentioned to countries that we typically don't consider the West. Singapore, for example. Singapore typically is very much a hybrid country in the sense it doesn't take a clear geopolitical position because that would shoot itself in the foot. They don't. But it's not always very clear to what extent, for example, Japan working with the United States is purely strategic and to what extent it is actually this Western vibe, this Western approach to reality. And, I don't think you can ever find an objective, rational answer. However, I do think it's useful to, as part of the Western bubble, to say, okay, do countries believe that they somehow have a superior political system called democracy, and are they eager to export that or eager to make sure that other countries follow their example? Do they emphasize things such as human rights? Do they believe that they are more modern, more advanced than other societies around them? Those would all be aspects of what we call the Western bubble.
And to find that out, to figure this out, whether... I mean, Australia in this episode is part of the Western bubble. It obviously makes most sense to talk to people from there. But as you rightfully mentioned, I mean, we hope to do these episodes or this type of episode in the future as well with someone from South Korea, someone from Japan, maybe even someone from New Zealand, who knows? There's not that many New Zealanders out there. So I think this will be a very, very interesting approach. I mean, we will now have our conversation together with Dan Bloch, right? As you mentioned, a good friend of ours who's also worked with us on the project that we sometimes mention, Raya, the think tank there, but he's also been a student of yours. And I think that we are very much looking forward to this conversation.
What's the international relations context?
So now with this segment, we actually have a guest here based on popular demand. We've always said that we would have more guests on. And for this part, given that we're talking about the non-NATO West or the Eastern West, we thought it would be interesting to have someone from Australia. And we have our good friend Dan Bloch here. Dan, how are you doing today?
Really well, thanks, Dario. It's good to be back with the Raya Circle. Boulder, pleasure to be speaking with you again as well.
Wonderful to see you again, Dan.
Exactly, because all the three of us have a bit of history together, right? I mean, Dan, you were also a student of Boulder's at IE University, and you were also part of the group of Raya, as you mentioned. So we're very happy to have you back here. What are you doing? What are you doing nowadays? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Dario. Yeah, these days I'm based in Geneva, so I'm back in Europe. There was a brief hiatus during the COVID years where it was the classic story of going back to Australia for 4 weeks to let this pandemic thing sort of brush over. And 2.5 years later, I was still stuck in Australia, but I made my way back. So these days I'm working in the energy transition side of the aviation industry, working for the International Air Transport Association. Still deeply rooted in the international affairs relations side of the equation, a lot of policy development analysis and then trying to quantify the benefits of developing sustainable aviation fuel solutions into broader macroeconomic and societal lenses as well. So, a nice melting pot of commercial policy and ultimately my biggest area of nerdiness, aviation. But as you say, was one of the co-founding members of Raya back in the day. Must be 2018, 2019. So the organization's certainly coming on leaps and bounds since then, and had the pleasure of being a student of Boulder's as well. So lots of fond memories, and it's really nice to be back in touch with the community.
Very nice. And as the audience can hear, you are Australian. You have a funny, funky accent.
Well noted. Very subtle.
Exactly. I would think so. And that's obviously kind of the reason why we're talking to you today, because you're a man of international relations. You are an Australian man as well. And therefore, I think the perfect kind of subject to study here and to be part of our case study. Let's start with kind of you more personally. Do you personally feel closer to the West as a whole concept, right? So democracy, human rights, I mean, it's the Anglo-Saxon world, and so on and so forth. Or do you feel closer to your region? Because if I had to locate Australia geographically, it would be in somewhere in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, it's a great question, Daria. I've been contemplating this for a little while, and I think you almost have to break it down into socio-cultural elements versus the political elements. Because invariably it is a bit of a paradox, certainly a bit of a hybrid. I think unquestionably, if we just look in terms of the political lens, it's clear that Australia is grounded and indeed founded in democratic values. And this is something that we uphold. And I want to explore that a little bit further later in the conversation. But if we come to more of the socio-cultural elements, we are invariably a melting pot. And that geography certainly plays into it. I mean, the first thing to really address is that the only true Australians are the Indigenous Australians. And that's a big element of our identity and understanding what it means to be the home of some of the oldest known living human population that we have on record. And sort of from there, our current population these days is really a makeup of various migrants that have come through over the previous generations. We have a well-founded story on the convicts coming from the UK, petty thefts and bread thieves, well done getting out of England and being sent to Australia. What a terrible punishment that was. But really, I mean, there is an enormous influence on Asian heritage within our population in this day and age. And ultimately, what makes Australia very interesting is I don't think there is a certain look of an Australian person. Really, there's some sort of quite almost at times comedic socio-tropes and norms that we really uphold that underpin what it means to be Australian far more than what you look like, because we are such a melting pot of cultural influences. We don't have a specific cuisine, for example, but rather we really value our barbecue culture that has to have fresh produce. You know, it's backyard cricket. It's making, you know, sort of light of situations. It's very much more sort of a socio-trait element culture rather than having a specific look with specific traditions. I think we really pride ourselves on the fact that, you know, what it means to be Australian is something that transcends just the optics. A great example I can share with you is even something as silly as, I'm sure you've heard of the Aussie, Aussie, Aussie concept, where the repeat is oi, oi, oi. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Istanbul on holiday with my partner and I thought I heard an Australian accent, and it was a lady that, you know, on the surface values, she looked like she potentially came from Southeast Asia, but I heard the accent and I was like, there's one way to test out. You're in the restaurant in public, Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. Sure enough, we got the oi, oi, oi back. And that was an experience. That's a connection. And really, like, that is as much what it means to be an Australian. There's a connection there. And I think this is the element of what makes us slightly different from, say, the US or indeed even the United Kingdom. Undoubtedly, these are also places that that come with their own diversity. But I'm not sure it's as integrated as effectively and almost, I dare say, invisibly as in Australia. I think the sects and the divisions in these parts of the world of traditional Western countries is far more visible, whereas in Australia, it's just accepted. This is how it is. We are an immigrant country and have diasporas and influences all over the place, and this is something we celebrate.
Then is that something that, if you make the comparison, for example, with the United States, because I think with the United Kingdom, it's very clear that the United Kingdom has always been struggling in going past that sort of white English cultural identity. But the United States is also very much a land of immigrants. And often the word melting pot is also something that's often used for the United States. But what seemingly binds them together is this belief beyond any cultural aspects, is the belief that they all are part of the land of the brave and the free. They all are part of this light on the hill for humanity to follow. They're all part of the greatest democracy on earth. Their words, not mine, etc., etc. Beyond this melting pot identity that you so beautifully describe in Australia, is there also an ideology that binds people together, this belief that you are, as a democracy, as a country that values freedom, that you represent something good about humanity?
You know what? It's a great question, Boulder. And in some respects, when I look at Australia with democracy, one of the questions that I see posed in my direction is Australian, or does it see itself as a bastion of democracy? And it really challenged me because on the one hand, for example, I think we really are quite a bastion for the democratic process. And within that, you know, we are really quite active and visible in how we really implore every citizen to become involved in the process. For example, it is compulsory to vote. If you do not vote, unless you have a very valid excuse, you are going to get a fine. So everyone gets involved in that particular process. There's even a ridiculous tradition called the democracy sausage, where you go and line up to vote and you have a sausage sizzle. Again, the barbecue culture coming through, and you have your democracy sausage on the day that you vote. I think where Australia potentially then falls over a little bit is then the ongoing engagement in between the election cycles. It's like we're so pleased that we've handed over the transition to government so effectively, so well, so by the book, that once we actually get to the political debate, the engagement, I think among the populace, having lived in different parts of the world, in Europe, the UK, as well as the US, I just get an empirical sense that we're not quite as politically engaged as a community as some of the other parts of the world. And I think this comes down to our isolation. So you then bring that back to your question in terms of what do we stand for? This isn't necessarily in the political rhetoric, but potentially in the socio-rhetoric. I think there's a sense of the broader we don't take ourselves that seriously. We're the larrikin, happy, lucky country far off that doesn't need to be involved in the same sort of way as a US or a UK. We're sort of happy to take that back step. I wouldn't necessarily translate into how the politicians perceive themselves as a regional power, but I think at a societal collective level, I don't see us having that same level of self-importance as, say, the US, who really, you know, will put their hand on their heart when singing the national anthem and think that we really are part of the greatest country in the world. Maybe it's that the US feels compelled to sort of say it out loud, whereas in Australia, we're a bit more contained with, we're just pleased with what we've got and, you know, we're far away in the distance and happy with our little slice of paradise.
And then so you would argue that there's not that delusion in our podcast over the past years. We've explored a lot that not just in the United States, but also in Europe, there's this inherent kind of arrogance about who they are. Not even necessarily directly about exporting the democracy or the freedom they represent, but simply ask an average Dutch person, how do you perceive your country? The Netherlands is a country that promotes peace and prosperity and is a beautiful society, and others would love to come here and live here, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this inherent kind of perspective on Dutch or European society being superior compared to nondescript other parts around the world. That doesn't exist in the same way in Australia, that delusion about superiority?
Look, I think to an extent, I think where the superiority complex comes into it is understanding almost the geographical benefits that we have, particularly when it comes to, you know, our environment and indeed our sort of raw material industries. Because what we know is we have a natural geographic arbitrage by virtue of just the raw materials that are at our disposal. We have what countries need. And as a consequence, that makes us a relevant player that almost to an extent we take for granted. They're going to come to us because they need what we have and what they don't have. And I think if there's anywhere where we have that sense of self-importance, it would be in there because, yeah, we're an export economy with our natural resources and all of our various commodities, which, for example, underpins why Australia went 30 years without having a recession, including during the global financial crisis. In fact, the reduced exchange rate meant that our exports were so cheap that we were just flooding, you know, different parts of Southeast Asia, not least China, which kept our economy afloat.
But that's very interesting, right? That maybe that sense of superiority or importance comes from, oh, we are just a very attractive player within the region. Because then at the same time, I mean, is that maybe the explanation for that trade war or trade conflict, let's call it that, that Australia is engaging or has engaged in with China, right? Who is its, I assume, most important economic partner?
Yeah, it's a great question again, Dario. And I think the way that we try and position ourselves there is, you know, I think in an ideal circumstance, we're the friendly neighbor that's able to establish relationships with everyone. But clearly with China, the challenge here is we are invariably aligned above all else with the US. Yes, we've got links with the UK and the Commonwealth, but ultimately, I think if I was to underpin the most important country and relationship for Australia in a geopolitical sense, it is the US. Every single defense treaty and alliance that the US has established, for example, in the Pacific, Australia is a part of it. And, you know, we understand why. The geographic relevance couldn't be more palpable. But within that, particularly in the Australia-Chinese dialogue, if you look at some of the dialogue that's taken place between prime ministers, particularly when we're trying to establish positive relations, the commentary and rhetoric is very much about let's treat each other as equals, recognize our differences as a societal and systematic level, but still understand that we can have mutually beneficial outcomes. I mean, we can go into the trade war and the dynamics, interestingly enough, to only 2 weeks ago at the WTO, the tariffs were lifted on things like wine and barley. And these were very significant tariffs to the extent that they made them completely uncompetitive in China. And this is, you know, going to have a significant flow-on effect in an Australian economy, which is very much reliant on the exportation of these materials and goods. So that's on the improve. But essentially, you know, I think Albanese, to that extent, put it really well in a recent comment where he's talked about the need to be able to cooperate where we can, disagree where we must, but ultimately act in the national interest. So, you know, what that encapsulates is a recognition that there's just some areas where we're never going to see eye to eye with China. And I think, you know, part of that is Australia is a culture and a political system that values the individual, and China, it values the state. And that's really where sort of your line in the sand is. But there is still a desire to have a working relationship. You've put the flip side onto China, and even when Australia called it out on the global scene during COVID, and this is really what sparked the recent heated exchanges and ultimately, I dare say, sort of diplomatic conflict between the two countries, China put a series of tariffs on various Australian goods like barley, like wine, like lobster, like meat. But do you know what the products that weren't tariffed?
Natural resources.
Iron ore, things that were going into their metals and their steels, which they just didn't have, but also no one else could provide them to the same extent and were absolutely essential to their economy. So it says everything you need to understand. There is just an element of the Australia-Chinese relationship embedded in trade that is sort of required on both sides of the equation, including China.
But this is fascinating to me, Dan, because in the first few times that you described Australia, it is this happy-go-lucky, very practically oriented kind of fun society that doesn't take itself too seriously. But if it has this practical approach, just practically looking, it's perfectly okay to say, hey, we have differences with China, But of course, China is the most important place for the exports of our minerals. That is the most important aspect of our economy that, as you just explained, has created economic growth and stability. So from a practical perspective, it doesn't make much sense to geopolitically align with the United States. And I often disrespectfully a little bit make the joke, but this is I'm happy to be disrespectful about the Netherlands, but of course I apologize to all Australians, that the United States foreign policy has two lapdogs in the world. One is the Netherlands and one is Australia. These two countries, the United States says jump and they will ask how high. Basically, automatically, the Netherlands and Australia will follow Washington in every direction. And that seems to be a conflict with respect to the practical reality that China is actually much more valuable to Australia in many ways. And so isn't this like a contradiction?
Yes and no. Let me come back to contradiction, by the way, in a moment, Boulder, because that's a really fascinating concept, particularly in the Chinese culture, and is really quite relevant to this discussion. I think the first comment, I wouldn't quite go as far as saying that China is a more valuable partner than the US. It's not to say it's an insignificant partner. It's clearly very important. But I think there is just some very fundamental humanistic cultural sort of alliance and sort of socio-agreements that are embedded in what it means to be as an Australian. Like I was saying before, we are far more rooted in this community-based value, understanding that the individual has a worth and a place in society, which we just do not align with in the way that the Chinese government and the state controls the sort of lived day-to-day experience in China. The other point to be made, I think, if we just bring in some numbers here. So China is indeed Australia's largest two-way trade partner, but it doesn't make up the majority. I mean, let me pose the question to you. In terms of a percentage, what do you think it makes up in terms of Australia's two-way trade?
Somewhere around,
I would argue about 20%.
Yeah, a little bit higher, but it's not the majority. About 35%. So it is large, but that's also come down in recent times. And there is a number of different partners, both in the region. Japan makes up a large quantum of that, as well as different parts of Western Europe and, of course, the US as well. And so even when, for example, China put on the tariffs post the COVID commentary back in 2020, the Australian economy didn't all of a sudden sink. So we've proven that whilst indeed they are an obvious and very viable trade partner and an important relationship as a consequence, we're not actually reliant. I think that commentary probably oversimplifies the situation. We've shown that when China doesn't, for whatever reason, want to import as much Australian material, we do have other options. So I think, again, I think I'd be a little bit more balanced in my personal perception of that, although I understand where you're coming from. I think undoubtedly there is a defiant allegiance to the US and aligning with their broader sort of diplomatic views on geopolitics.
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, it's very fair. I don't always do balance in this, certainly in this podcast, right? We have to keep things fun. The way that you then describe this is it goes exactly to the root of our podcast, right? Because basically what you're saying is, yes, at a practical level, China is not the only game in town. There are much other important players. The United States is also an important player. But the real reason why we geopolitically align with the United States is this sense of identity, that we connect our identity to that of the West. We connect our identity to that of Washington, maybe even London, less so as you explained. But and that is actually exactly that Western bubble mentality, right? So it is not just about practicalities. It's also about this feeling of belonging to the Western tribe.
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question and sort of statement to sort of pose. And I think in some respects, there's an element of an identity, I don't want to quite say crisis, but we're in the process of still self-discovery. I mean, you know, we as a country received independence in 1901. You know, we still understand the links. I mean, for all intents and purposes, the king is our head of state, or serves as that symbolic figure for us. And I think it's quite reflective of the fact that we are still figuring ourselves out in some respects. You know, we're showing signs of adolescence as a country. And that has to evolve, undoubtedly. But I think there's just sociotropes that will invariably align us with what we invariably link with the West. But I don't think it's quite as simple to place us in the bucket of a US in the way that we operate and engage with our regional neighbours, because I think in quite a different way we are exposed to neighbours in proximity to us that are not Western, for example, or not classified in this bubble. For example, Indonesia is one of the largest countries in the world by way of the Muslim population, and that's one of our major neighbours just next door to us. I mean, a flight from my city, Perth, to Bali is half the flight time of flying to Sydney. And so as a consequence of that, you know, we sort of are exposed to those cultures far more prominently in the same way, actually, they're just reflected in the makeup of the society that lives within the four walls of Australia. So those cultural influences are sort of reflected and integrated in a way that forms a bit of a hybrid. I think what Australia does quite well is respect the different ways that all these diasporas both influence and integrate simultaneously the ultimate lived experience in Australia. And that's why I describe it as quite a melting pot, even relative to the US example, where I feel like the melting pot sort of all feeds into the American dream, the American way, whereas in Australia, I think we're kind of still creating what it means to be Australian, even as the world sort of, you know, deals with a lot of these sort of developments in becoming more progressive societies and how we balance the sort of the visible representation of different cultures, being sensitive to, you know, even things like gender and sexual orientation, and finding a way as a country to marry that up with a population that is also filled with completely different religions that have altering views on these particular topics as well. And I think that does still make Australia a bit more complex than just a black and white, it fits in the Western bubble, but it does or it doesn't.
Absolutely right. And this is exactly why we're recording this episode today. And I think this is exactly why we're having you on here, because I mean, the impression I've received so far is that on a foreign policy level, and maybe on a Western bubble level, Australia does link up with the West in that sense. But then on everything else, right, simply because what you mentioned is that it's in the region, right? It's in the Southeast Asian region. As you said, your closest neighbors are non-Western countries in that sense. So how does Australia see and perceive itself in the region, right? Because I don't think Australia is going to say, oh, we are a lapdog of the United States.
No, that's me, Dario. That's not Australian.
Exactly, right? But at the same time, right, so there is then this combination out of, hey, we are a melting pot and a bit of an experiment as a country. We are definitely Western influenced in that sense, right? So we do believe in democracy and the importance of the individual within a community and so on and so forth. How does that factor then into the region? Because of what you said at the beginning, right, that there's also a certain sense of superiority due to the economic position and, right, the resource richness of the continent.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I really want to qualify this not as a global view but a regional view. I think there is a sense of we have a strong leadership role to play. Now, that creates a very interesting dynamic because, for example, we're a population, forget the size of Australia, our population barely exceeds 25 million. But you could fit Spain in the bottom left corner of my state, not the country, just the state of Western Australia. So, you know, it's a fascinating dynamic. To have, you know, such a relatively small population try and place such an importance on its country and influence at the regional level. The fact that, again, I want to come back to the example of when Australia stood up to China and claimed that it was preventing investigation during the COVID-19 situation. This was a very forward position to take. I mean, why Australia? Why is it us that we're making that kind of commentary? And clearly, at least at a political level, it demonstrates a confidence in both A, almost like the soft power of the country and the fact that we are an influential voice somehow when it comes to Asia-Pacific dialogue, but B, that there is sort of a weight of support behind what we would have to say. And I suppose that's almost showing, because I'm not familiar with how much it was discussed with the US that Australia would come out and say this instead of the US, but I think we wouldn't have said the comment if we weren't very confident that the US was there sitting behind us too. So I think that gives us a certain sense of inflation of a perception of what we can and can't say in these global settings. So I think that's really where I'd bring it down to. It's because we have such a confidence in the foundations of our alliances, particularly the defence alliances, that gives us the impetus that possibly transcends that of a 25 million population country, if that makes sense.
So is that the would that be the reason why there is this Western foreign policy approach, that without that alliance, Australia would be less able to take a leadership position in the region? So basically, this automatic dependence, or if you like, dependability of their connection with Washington allows Australia to be more aggressively putting itself forward at a regional level.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair assessment, Boulder, and particularly also then if, and I really want to try and refrain from getting too, I'm not going to say political because that's exactly what we're doing right now, but I don't want to get too contentious. But when we start looking into then scenarios around, say, Taiwan, to a lesser extent, Hong Kong, I think also that gives us a bit more impetus to reinforce that we stand for human rights, that we stand, you know, for the rights of those living in self sort of self-defining sovereign countries that want to, for example, live under the pretenses of democracy. I think if we didn't have such explicit relationships and partnerships with bigger sort of defensive powers, we would probably have a quieter voice. I think that's a really fair assessment.
And so that goes then back to the idea of Australia also a little bit along the lines of my first question initially, seeing itself as this light on the hill, right? Like protecting this moral framework that the West stands for.
Yeah, no, and again, it's also why I would have differentiated the political answer versus the populist answer. I think from a political perspective, there is absolutely this kind of understanding. And really the way that we've seen that delivered from various administrations over the years, where the variance has taken place is how aggressive was that sort of dialogue? Were some going to be standing up to China and really framing it as, hey, we are sort of trying to force your hand in sort of recognizing that you've done something wrong here? Or is it coming from more of an understanding approach and sort of saying, well, we've got to be a bit more gentle with the way that we communicate and more sensitive to the cultural tropes that we know are associated with China too. But in both cases, I think we're seeing that there is something that we're standing for, and namely they're sort of embedded in your sort of principles of human rights, the right to self-determination as a country, and these sort of principles that we definitely would associate with the West. I guess, you know, to almost call into criticism at times where possibly our leaders may have fallen short is not being sensitive enough to the partners that we were dealing with. And it doesn't just relate to China exclusively, but you may remember, for example, in 2017, Malcolm Turnbull had a very famous line in a media statement. He was the Prime Minister at the time, and it was coming off the back of allegations against Chinese spies in Australia. And essentially, Turnbull has stood up and addressed the Australian population and said, look, you know, in 1949, modern China was founded with the words Zhongguo Renmin Zheng Qi Lai, which is the Chinese people stand up. It's also, for what it's worth, stated that that was a misquote and Mao never said that. We're not here to determine if that's what took place or not, but this is what Turnbull said. And he said, you know, this was a statement of assertion of sovereignty and assertion of pride. And so we say, Odalia Renmin Zheng Qi Lai, So the Australian people stand up, and that just went down like a lead balloon in China. And it just came across as entirely culturally insensitive. And even though you could see what he was trying to do, he was trying to stand up for Australia, saying that, you know, having the potential of Chinese spies in our country is just completely not on. You just have to understand the sensitivities of communication and dialogue. I mean, it comes back, for example, to the comment around around contradiction, Boulder. So in Mandarin or Chinese, the word Mao Dong means it means contradiction, and it literally translates to sword and shield. And so within sort of Chinese philosophy, and indeed how they act as government administrations, they use contradiction quite interestingly and strategically, where they will intentionally try and push out potential strategies and even positionings when it comes to maybe bilateral relations, and then ultimately come back and reverse that decision to something else. Because it is a demonstration of consideration, of reflection, of taking in new information and showing a willingness to change and adopt different strategies. Whereas I think in a Western society, we don't deal with contradiction very well. We don't deal very well with changing of tacks and approaches. I think we almost interpret it as duplicitous, for example. But if we take a little bit more time to understand our neighbours and who we're dealing with and actually have a bit more empathy in those geopolitical engagements, then you actually might sort of drop these scenarios where we just come across as being culturally insensitive and potentially harming the relationship further. And I think this is where we've been a little bit at fault, where we've not been capable of stepping out of our lane in our dialogues and needed probably more to step into the space of the Chinese leaders and the mentality there and have an appreciation for their culture and background philosophy, which we acknowledge is very different to ours.
See, this is, I mean, because you basically said that politically, right, from a political perspective, Australia is definitely part of the Western bubble. I take from the things you said at the beginning that on a population level, this is not necessarily the case, because, I mean, and I think we can confidently call Australia an experiment as a country because of the culture that you described. So while Australian politics are very much within the Western bubble, in 2024, let's say in 40-50 years, when that culture basically has also reached politics in that sense, do you think that this might change, that there will be a realignment of Australia away from the West, maybe more towards the region, maybe more towards its own thing, or a bit of a hybrid?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there is a real potential over the next 50 years for that dependence on the US relationship to change. It's not to say that the US will become unimportant. It may just be the relative importance of other countries within our region will increase. I mean, there's a lot of work being done to increase ties with India, a number of countries through ASEAN as well. The body of ASEAN is really quite an important player within that. And even then engagements with Japan and Korea. But clearly these are also allies in many respects to the US as well. The question is, do we create more standalone relationships and dynamics away from the US? And that's the question in my mind that needs to play out. But certainly I don't think it can be sort of just completely neglected in terms of the debate that I don't want to take for granted that there are a lot of individuals in Australia that are very politically engaged, but I think the average Australian relative to the average European or US is less politically engaged. And I dare say that's because there is less history involved. There's also, I think, just less sort of socio scope for that kind of discourse, because our lifestyle is so I think diversified, it's quite active. The cultural socio tropes are very much driven by time outdoors, playing lots of sport. And I don't want to be too laissez-faire in how I say this, but it's almost like we don't want to talk about politics. We want to go out and live life. And, you know, and there's almost a bit of a lackadaisical mentality when it comes to just political rhetoric over the dinner table. You know, don't bring politics home. And so maybe that does have some sort of institutional influence over the coming decades, particularly if we are growing more and more alienated with certain elements of what's taking place in the US. I mean, I can tell you categorically that there is a genuine fear of sort of the concept of Americanization of Australian politics, namely that it becomes almost a farce in the way that it is so strictly down the lines of a two-party system, where it's entirely divisive. I mean, for what it's worth, Australia does have a very dominant two-party system. The only difference between the US and Australia in that sort of sense is where red and blue in the US is really quite clearly defined. I would say that we have got a centre-centre-left and a centre-centre-right, two sort of major parties set up in Australia where you can hardly tell the difference a lot of times. And so even to that extent, the quality of political debate that takes place between the two administrations is at times hard to really distinguish. So I think if anything, it's more to suggest that there is room for evolution. And if the US can't sort out its system, that inspiration is not going to come from the US.
Thanks so much, Dan. That was, again, for me, I mean, not going to lie, the main takeaway is, of course, Western bubble focused. And at the same time, I'm absolutely astonished again, every day again, how big Australia is. How would you, like, now that we're at the end of this, so how would you summarize Australia's position within the Western bubble or as part of the West in that sense?
Look, I think overall, where we most clearly align with the Western bubble, to use that phrasing, is on the socio side of the equation. We understand the norms at a cultural level is very much embedded in freedom of the individual, human rights, freedom of expression, the right to self-determination. And this is where the clear sort of sense of alignment takes place. And I think there is a real strong understanding that we don't just need to, but want to defend that, which is why you can see the defense alliances with these typically associated Western bubble countries. Where we differ is then more on how we interact with everyone else. If you like, I see Raya all the time referring to the concept of frenemies. I think we're very willing to have a number of frenemies on the basis that it serves the national interest, particularly the economic interest, which is why we're able to establish trade relations in a way that doesn't necessarily alienate our position within the Western bubble, but simultaneously is able to acknowledge and appreciate that there are going to be actors out there that are going to want our raw materials that don't align with our potentially socio-political approaches. Once again, I think at the moment, if anyone captured it the best would be our current Prime Minister, who said we must cooperate where we can, disagree where we must, and the use of the word must, I think, is quite telling there, and ultimately act in the national interest. So it goes to show we are rooted in possibly the social values of the West, but at a political level are willing to be potentially a bit more expansive and have the luxury of doing so because we are a relatively small country. A regional power indeed, but on the global level, we're just a puzzle piece.
Wow, perfect. Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you very much. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure, Dario. Boulders, a lot of fun.
A genuine pleasure, Dan, and I love just listening to you and the articulate way in which you describe these things. It's we should have you on the show every week.
Well, I'm happy to come back again. I mean, at some point in time, if you want to do something on the world of energy transition and energy politics, this is something that's very much in my world. So if that ever comes up, feel free.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much, Dan.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
What an interesting conversation. I mean, obviously it's Dan, so I'm never worried of not having an interesting conversation when it comes to Dan. But there are so many interesting factors for the Western bubble here. And I mean, let's start immediately with what could be the damage of Australia being part of the Western bubble? Because, I mean, ultimately, that just means that there's another country within the Western bubble that, you called Australia a little bit a lapdog, right? But that simply acts in accordance with Western foreign policy. And that means that it also participates in invasions, right? In Western military actions against certain countries.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, of course, Dan gave a bit of pushback against that. And I did already, before I used the word lapdog, apologize to all Australians. I will never apologize to the Dutch people because they are my tribe and I can insult them as much as I like. There is the two sides to it. Dan clearly pointed out that this alliance from the Australian perspective, the alliance with the United States gives them a power base. It gives them a point of strength. It allows them to play more of a leadership role than otherwise would be the case. But at the same time, the price you pay for that alliance is exactly that you start being militarily active in parts of the world where you don't have any strategic interest. That is sort of the flip side of this implicit agreement that you have with Washington or even with European capitals. And on top of that, as Dan also pointed out, as time goes by, the nature of Australia, the identity of Australia is changing. In the future, this might become a problem, right? There might be damage between the traditional belief that Australia is part of that Western bubble and the realities of a changing environment and a changing identity at home. So the damage is clearly that in order to get the advantages of being part of this Western geopolitical force, if you like, you're going to have to pay a price. You're going to have to do things that aren't directly in your own interest, that might be destructive, that might be unhelpful. And on top of that, you're going to face a future with a declining West that might actually create problems for who you are and who you want to be.
And I think we can almost quantify that, right? With the trade conflict, war, whatever you want to call it, with China, is because I'm not sure whether some of the actions of Australia against China, and right, I'm not sure to what extent they would have done it if they weren't part of that Western bubble, and ultimately that means that would have cost them.
Yeah, so it's an important aspect of Western thinking, and this also was pointed out by Dan, is this belief that you have a responsibility when it comes to human rights, when it comes to moral concerns, and you need to defend those moral concerns. You need to defend that responsibility. You need to tell other countries that they are on the wrong side of history. And that comes with a big price. That comes with a cost, especially if that country that you're telling off is a country that your economy depends on, is a country that your future political stability depends on, right? And so this is the tension that we discussed about the practical reality of Australia, which might not be helped by this ideological Western framework, and at the same time the identity of Australia still believing itself to be part of this Western world.
And what now?
But wasn't that so interesting how Dan, very much at the beginning of that segment with him, described the Australian culture and identity, right? Because it's very much disconnected from the political side. I mean, politically, Australia is very much a part of the Western bubble. But then when it comes to, right, that melting pot that he described, and just, right, also the relations with the Indigenous Australians, in the future, there might be a change to this, right? And I asked him point blank, I mean, hey, maybe in 50 years, that culture of being very relaxed and kind of understanding each other and understanding each other's backgrounds, if that comes into politics, that is then a different political culture than the one we're seeing right now, which is the Western bubble.
Yeah, there is no doubt that the nature of Australia, the identity of Australia, as Dan described it, and this is basically exactly following his words, right, is going to create this moment in time where the traditional Western bubble thinking that still is clearly present in Australia is going to have to make way for new realities. And that future in which that happens will be one that isn't necessarily easy to overcome. You're going to have this struggle between the old and the new, and that's always a tricky process, right? That's always a difficult transition. The identity, the realistic nature of Australia, of being
multicultural, being this melting pot, being not dependent of if you like the patriarchal Western identity or whatever it is that however you want to describe it, but having a different identity that moves away from that Western bubble thinking is going to clash with those who still want to hang on to their own self-image, to their own bubble thinking of this is what we do, we have this moral superiority, we have this political superiority, and we have to defend that. And in that sense, I mean, it's not going to necessarily lead to disaster, but it's certainly a challenge that a country like Australia, like many other countries, will have to face in the next 30, 40, 50 years.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the Eastern West. If you have any questions, comments, or regards, make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Today, we're going to have a closing quote from our guest, so we'll now hear it from Dan.
Thanks once again, Boulder and Dario. Been a pleasure to be on the podcast today and feeling very special to be able to wrap up today's session with a quote, as is customary on the Western bubble. And I'm going to go back to Bob Hawke, my favourite ever Australian Prime Minister of the Labor Party, ran two administrations between 83 and 91. And I think he really underpinned the best parts of the Australian identity, very charismatic and funny, very connected with the everyday Australian, so to speak. And I think more importantly, was such a strong advocate for human rights, be that across labour rights, self-determination, gender, and even in the way he handled international affairs, really trying to develop and drive positive relationships with our neighbours, regardless of political alignment, but rather identifying ways in which we could connect based on fundamental human understanding. And I think it's captured really nicely in this quote, where he reflected upon his prime ministership in 1998. And he said, at every level of human relationships, be it personal, economic, cultural, or sporting, a unity of understanding and purpose is rightly regarded as a desirable element in achieving success. The principle is no less true at the highest level of the nation's affairs. I think it captures magnificently the beauty of Australia and what we can be, even depicting the importance of sport in that socio-realm that we play in. Overall, I think Australia can play a really important role in the ASEAN and Asia-Pacific region, where we can toe the line of being an ally of the West while still having strong, meaningful and human-based relationships with the likes of China and those not necessarily aligning with our political views. There is still absolutely scope for relationships for Australia to have at an appropriate level with these neighbours. But as Albanese would also say, we still have to disagree where we must. Thank you once again.